is saying here. First touch. Now can he get the shot away? He can!
There's an air of vulnerability that comes off him. Why is that?
Say more about that.
Say more about it. Is that one of your fucking psychotherapist questions?
I mentioned that last week's show, after I spoke with Tom, that we would be speaking this week to somebody from Las Vegas. Unfortunately, myself and Killian haven't made the trip ourselves. We're not speaking to you today from Nevada. We're currently sitting around the corner from the Second Captain studio here in Dublin, where we're going to very shortly be speaking to this week's very special guest, CNN's Donny O'Sullivan. Welcome to episode.
I think this is almost certainly the first time on the show that we've spoken to a guest who can just use their first name as their Twitter handle, Richie.
Yes.
It's just at Donny, which I love, and I think is a nice signifier of the kind of recognition he's gotten in the last couple of years.
He is. He's huge. He's big time. Now, I think a lot of people, just like myself actually, would have only first become aware of Donny when he was reporting from outside the Capitol building in Washington on January the 6th. That was back during COVID times in 2021. Now, I remember, I'm sure I kind of been the only one who was really shocked and gripped by what I was watching, but I was also really surprised. There was an Irish journalist standing in front of me on the ground that was walking us through everything as it was unfolding in real time. But I remember just a few weeks later reading an interview Donny gave with the Irish Times, which stuck out in my mind. He spoke about January the 6th, but in a very different context, actually. He spoke about what I think he called the chaos in his mind, spells of anxiety, spells of depression. And he described what really came across as what sounded like terrifying panic attacks. But what struck me was he used the phrase that it was all far more terrifying for him than the riots at the Capitol, which is a hell of a statement, really. And he was doing it all from a position where at that time he had become suddenly incredibly well known everywhere, particularly in Ireland. And I think it was less than a year later, actually, it was only around about a year, where a documentary about his life and his career aired on RTE. So that was a kind of profile that he very quickly grew. So I want to speak to him today about kind of how does he look back at that time and those experiences, why he decided to speak about them, and obviously, like, how's he doing now?
Yeah, and that initial decision to come out and talk about it, Richie, is really interesting, because I think most people's natural response would be to keep that side of their life out of the spotlight and to keep building their profile as a journalist, because for context, Donny was only 29 at that point. And as you say, yeah, like how he's doing now will be very interesting to hear, because I think he recognized at the time that those mental health issues that he was having like might rear their head again in the future. And because, like, at the moment, it seems to me that those experiences are informing how he does his reporting today. So a lot of his work would deal with, like, conspiracy theories and fringe groups like QAnon. And, for example, he recently made a documentary about a group who believe that JFK and JFK Jr. descend from Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
That they're alive and well, and that they're working with Donald Trump today. Now, rather than try and show these people up or lampoon them, he came at the documentary from the angle of speaking to the families of some of this group's members. And, you know, some of them went from leading genuinely normal, mundane lives to leaving their families behind so they could basically dedicate their life to this conspiracy theory. And Donny seems to come to the conclusion that pretty much with, you know, most of the members, trauma has played some significant part in them making that choice of leaving their family behind. And in some cases, that trauma is probably not something entirely dissimilar to what he's gone through himself. So I'm really looking forward to hearing about that as well.
Yeah, like, he does have a really fascinating job, quite apart from all the mental health and well-being stuff I want to ask him about. I hope he opens up a little bit about the work he does. Right, let's head to the studio now and speak to this week's guest, Donny O'Sullivan. Donny, how are you doing? You're very welcome to episode. Thanks a million for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. Absolute pleasure to be here.
You're joining us from Las Vegas. What has you there?
I am, yeah, my serious gambling addiction. No, I've been out in Vegas a lot this year. Nevada is a swing state here on top of everything else. And it's really a bit of a kind of ground zero for a lot of the stuff I cover, which is the conspiracy theories, election, MAGA movement, all that sort of stuff. So I've been here quite a bit.
So I really want to talk to you in loads of depth about all of that. But You would have come to most people's attention as this kind of fully formed journalist on big time American TV. When did the desire to become a journalist begin?
When I was a kid, I think my mom has a photo of me when I was 3 or 4 years old interviewing the teddy bears in the sitting room at home in Carrigaline. So I always wanted to be a journalist, but didn't quite frankly expect that I'd be on the TV and things like that. I was, you know, always a bit of a nerd and computer guy, and was very into social media and the internet and stuff like that. So I started working with Mark Little in Storyful back in Dublin, back about 10, 12 years ago now. And so somehow ended up over here.
One area I really want to talk to you about, and one of the things you did, and you did it not long after becoming really, really well known, you spoke openly and publicly about your own mental health challenges.
Yeah.
What was behind the decision to do that? Because not everyone would go down that road.
Well, you know, as you say, most probably people in Ireland would never have heard of me until they were watching TV in COVID lockdown on January 6th, 2021. And a lad with a big Kerry head pops up outside the Capitol with a mask that can't cover his face properly. It was a bit mad. It was really mad. You know, I'd been kind of covering a lot of that kind of election denial movement and stuff in the US for quite some time, and been doing some stuff on TV, and that brought me to the Capitol that day, and because I knew a lot of these people were going to be there, and then lo and behold, kind of showed up on TV in that way. And it was weird, right? Because Irish people were so proud. It was, you know, very heartwarming to see so much pride and love coming from Ireland, and there was all these memes and things. And one, it was pretty weird in that, like, I was covering a major attack on American democracy and the biggest story of my career, and something very serious and sad and profound. And, you know, people died that day, or people died as a result of that day. And then on the other side of things, I kind of opened my social media feed and the sun was shining out of my arse in Ireland. You know, I could do no wrong. And I, you know, I've been on the Late Late Show and all this stuff over, like, obviously it was COVID, so it was over remote and all that. But it was just so overwhelming. But one thing that really kind of stuck out to me was, as I saw this kind of coverage and all, everybody meaning very well, of course, was they were like, hey, he was so calm. You know, Donny was so calm that day with all the chaos happening around him. And yeah, no, I was on the train back. I just said, if only people knew. I mean, I might be calm in that moment, but, like, you know, I'm not this like Zen character, and I have a lot of demons and a lot of times that I'm not calm in my mind. And I wanted to use the kind of 15 minutes of fame, as it were, to actually talk about something meaningful. And I don't know, rather than just doing a ton of interviews about how the day itself and how supposedly great I was, I wanted to do something more meaningful.
Did you run that idea past colleagues or friends before you did that interview?
Yeah. And some people kind of said it wasn't a good idea. You know, they're like, you're on your way up here. You know, this could be, there's still a stigma with this stuff. But I, you know, I was very much like, well, fuck it. That's the whole point. I want to talk about this. And you know, I think, like, we all read these, like, mental health stories of people who are like, I got through the other side of it and it's great. And look how successful I am now. And I kind of wanted to just paint a bit more of a realistic view to say, it's like, no, this is something I'm still dealing with a lot and have since, by the way, I've dealt with a lot since 2021. And just to say, you know, you can get to a place where you can get on with things, but it's not like you've left this stuff behind. But I will say, I mean, everybody at CNN and the bosses all the way up to the very top of the organization, when the story came out in the Irish Times, was so supportive. But I also viewed myself as in this kind of privileged and strong position, right? That I I kind of had a good hand at that point. America, CNN needed somebody to figure out the conspiracy theories and all that. So I don't know if, you know, if I was a bit younger and starting out and stuff, maybe I would be afraid to talk more about mental health, because you know, of course you'd be afraid that some boss is going to think you're mad and you can't do your job.
Would any of your colleagues have known about it before they read it in that interview, or was that news to them?
No, most probably would not have. Yeah, I wasn't necessarily hiding it. You know, I've been fairly open with it about my friends and stuff over the years. I mean, it was really kind of, it's all kind of really blew up for me when I was doing a postgrad in Belfast back around 2012 and started having panic attacks and stuff like that. And just kind of life quickly descended into this constant state of fear and anxiety and depression. So I'd worked kind of very hard to overcome that. And then when I moved to America in 2016, all was grand. I was on my antidepressants for years, hadn't done therapy for a while, long time, just feeling fine, thinking, you know, I was unstoppable. And then it kind of hit me like a ton of bricks, I think around 2017 or 18. And actually, Samantha Barry, who's Cork woman from Ballinacollig, who I know knows the second captain's lads very well. I think they were college roommates back in the day in DCU, I think. You know, she was one of my bosses at CNN, and there was a time where I had to, you know, I was really finding it rough, and I was able to come and speak to her about it before we're friends now, but it was when she was my boss. So having somebody like that was great.
What was your understanding of what was going on when this first happened, when you were up in Belfast? Did you, like, you're using the language now of, you know, panic attacks and anxiety and depression, yeah, but when it first started to be something you were experiencing, what was your understanding of it?
Oh, I thought I was having a heart attack.
Really?
You know, I'd gone to college in Dublin, and I had a kind of good time there and community around me, and I loved Dublin. And a girlfriend there and everything else. And then you moved to Belfast, which, yeah, it was obviously a big change and stuff like that, and lots of things like that. And I think when you leave college and go into postgrad, you're kind of really wondering, fuck, right, what am I doing with my life? But yeah, I think, you know, there was, yeah, just one Sunday night, I was lying in bed and woke up to like heart palpitations. And yeah, I just truly thought I was having some kind of heart attack. Yeah, it's kind of scary to think back in it now, but it just quickly really manifested.
Is it hard to recall those moments?
A bit, in that I've talked about it quite a bit with friends and stuff, but yeah, it just was the beginning of this, like, it seemed to, like, that was November 2012, kind of. I always remember the night. And it just, like, I remember I was actually doing an internship as part of my postgrad at Belfast up in Stormont. And yeah, I just remember the next day running into the bathroom every 20 minutes, thinking I needed to puke, or puking, and just having this total sense of nausea. And went home at Christmas to my parents in Kerry, and, you know, my parents might disagree, but I don't think I ever caused them too much hassle. I was always a pretty good kid, and never would, yeah, I just kind of sort shit out on my own. But yeah, we were out for dinner one night and driving back home, and my two younger sisters, Kerry and Sinead, were in the car with me, and we got to the house and they hopped out of the car, and I just said to my mom and dad, I was like, I need to talk to you guys. And yeah, I just kind of broke down crying. And at the time I was obsessing about, like, I think I had a fucking, like, overdraft from AIB or something of a grand, and like how I was going to pay the back. But like, and I had this thing where I was like, look, I haven't told you guys this, but I have this overdraft, blah, blah, blah. But crying, and I mean, they had never seen me like this, and they were like, that's okay, it's all good, you know, it's fine. But I think I knew then that it was, you know, I kind of knew then it was more than about an overdraft from the AIB.
Do you think your parents knew at the time?
I think so. I think they, yeah, I think they did. I think they probably knew before me. Yeah, I knew that, like, before I went back to Belfast, we kind of chatted about me seeing a doctor and things like that. And but yeah, it was one of those things that, you know, I remember actually being in UCD and like a few years before that, and seeing all the stuff on campus about welfare and mental health and all that. And a part of me actually kind of thinking, half of that is bullshit. You know, really kind of the shake it off and get on with it mentality. So yeah, it was a kind of whole new awakening for me. Of course, now looking back, I can see moments true since teenagers and childhood that I had a lot of this stuff. But yeah, I mean, I think one thing, you know, I think I had going into the conversation with my parents that my mom would get this, that she'd know something was up. And, you know, based off no evidence at all whatsoever, I just had an idea in my head that my dad wouldn't understand, that he would be of the, sure, come on, get your act together, it'll be grand. But, you know, and my dad is not like that in any way. He's never he never did anything or was dismissive when I was young to inform that. But I think I just had this idea in my head of, like, Irish dad wouldn't get it, etc. But he immediately got it. And that was also quite nice.
That must have been lovely.
You know. Yeah, it was. Yeah, and then, you know, that was a very tough year after that. Started seeing, I mean, I was through fucking horrors for months. It was awful, awful. I managed to finish out the postgrad somehow, but Jesus Christ, there was very dark days. But I eventually got on some medicine and therapy, and it was about 6, 7, 8 months after that eventually kind of upped the meds a bit and moved stuff around, and it was like I like got my life back. It was crazy.
How did you find going to therapy?
Very good.
Really?
Yeah, and I still go now. I have a therapist in the US. Sound pure American, what? Shrink. The first therapist I went to one in, I mean, Queen's Belfast was brilliant. They had like a lot of services like that, and they really got it. And I had a therapist there, or counselor there, for a few sessions. But it eventually got so bad to the point that kind of when I finished up my postgrad, I just had to stop. And I went home to Kerry for a while because I wasn't getting better. And that was fairly terrifying, because to me, that was like, I have failed. You know, I'm never going to leave the bedroom in my parents' house. Yeah, just taking that break, stopping. I was afraid to stop, which I think, like a lot of people, you know, it's not an unusual thing in that I think we're so used to going through school and then you go through college and like you always know what you're doing the next September, right? and then life comes and you're like, fuck. But yeah, I spent a few months home in Kerry and started seeing a counselor there. And yeah, it was, but I very much went in, I don't know, I had the attitude, I was like, if I'm going to therapy, I am like laying it all out here. I'm not, like, I'm going, I am participating, and I'm telling you fucking everything. yeah, so that got me on track. And then kind of as I was feeling better, happened to see this job at Mark Little Storyful, got in with the startup in Dublin, and really, you know, it was like night and day. It felt like I got my life back, and it was brilliant. We had so much crack in the Storyful offices back in the day in Dublin. It's kind of real startup vibe. Looking back on it, I mean, I was drinking the arse out of it and had, you know, things that I would later learn were unhealthy, but I was just so happy to be living at that point.
I remember when I first went to therapy, I
was living with a mate of mine in England at the time, and I made up a cover story every week. I just wouldn't tell anyone at all that I was going to therapy. I, at the time, perceived it as this is a real sign that I'm a failure. It was just something that you, in the world I was in at the time, you just would not talk openly about that.
Yeah. And I think, like, when I started going, I did, you know, I started going to therapy pretty quickly in Belfast. And I think I had a bit of that stigma or that feeling about it, but I eventually started telling friends about it. And of course they were shocked, and yeah, the first few people I told, I found it difficult to tell them because, you know, you're telling them you're mad. But it was my biggest fear for a while was about medicine. I just thought that it makes you a different person, that it dulls you, that it makes you a zombie. You know, like this, it all happened fairly rapidly for me. I had the panic attack in November. I would say by like Christmas, I kind of knew in my heart that this wasn't going to be something to solve just by talking. I just could, like, physiologically, it was the sweats. My muscles would be sore because I'd be so tense. But yeah, I was terrified of any medicine because I was like, that's, you know, medicine, and next thing I'll be in St. Pat's for the rest of my life.
That was your thinking at the time?
Yeah. I just thought, and of course, like, I was going on all the internet forums, reading the horror stories, the disaster. I mean, that was the thing. I Googled so much that year about just trying to, you know, what you could do. But yeah, I eventually, after about 6 months, I, you know, went to my doctor back down in Carrigaline. And yeah, he was like, you got to get on, like, some medicine will help. And I do actually remembering, though, like, that felt to me like a failure, that, you know, I'd done a few months of therapy and stuff, and I wasn't seeing an improvement. And yeah, I actually remember just putting the first, like, pill into my mouth, being like, what am I doing? But I don't really know where that came from. I guess I'm, you know, these are powerful drugs, but they're not kind of powerful in the way that's, you know, you're kind of one flew over the cuckoo's nest type thing, which I guess was kind of how I was thinking about it.
So you were jumping to all of those images of institutionalized, or the, you know, the word crazy, or just the real me is going to just be fade away now. I'm going to be the medicated version of me, whatever that is.
Exactly. Yeah. Which in itself is that kind of paranoia and anxiousness in itself is a symptom of, you know, it's a messy, self-fulfilling prophecy in that way sometimes, because you're like, I don't want to go on any of this because it shows that I'm mad. And then drive yourself mad about that.
What were those initial weeks and months like? Were you monitoring and being really, really careful to monitor the impact?
I think I kind of think it might have been after a few days, once they saw that I wasn't this zombie, that I started to get more comfortable with it. You know, like, these drugs, obviously it depends on different type of medication, but like the SSRIs can take 6 to 8 weeks to work, all that sort of stuff. So they're like a slow acting, you know, it's not like you're taking some, popping it in your mouth and you immediately feel a difference. So in that way, that kind of almost made me more comfortable with it. And then, I mean, I could really see, it was kind of another 6 months where I upped the dose of one and kind of tweaked around. And it was actually really after that I could see a bit of change, but plus the therapy, plus everything else. So I got over the fear pretty quick. I mean, I'd obviously say that I think in America, they have a culture of over-prescribing, especially to children and everything. It's too much. And so I think, you know, I think it's probably okay to have a little bit of skepticism or to certainly not want to just jump into doing these pills because they do have side effects. But yeah, that fear subsided after a while and was great.
It sounds like you kind of got back on your feet quite quickly.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I mean, it had been a full kind of 12, 14 months from panic attack to thing. But yeah, I was really, really happy. And it was all kind of plain sailing for a few years until it wasn't.
Until it wasn't. When wasn't it? You mentioned earlier 2017 and you're in America at this point.
Yeah, 2017, kind of thing. I went through a, I mean, it was a breakup of a short relationship. But again, it was just one of those, a trigger of something that was underlying. And that's when I started seeing a therapist in the US and started figuring out stuff. And making a kind of long story short, things got better again after tough enough 6 months or so. But then it really all kind of kicked off again after January 6th. 2022 for me was an awful year. You know, the underlying reasons as to why it all came about is we could talk about that too. But I learned a lot more about my illness in that year, because I really started to understand that, like, you know, I go from stages of baseline anxiety. And if I get too much anxiety, I can end up being a bit depressed. You know, if I'm like, fuck it, I'm waking up to this again today. But all of that stuff, and that comes in peaks and troughs. Like, I still, you know, there's days that I just fucking hate shit, like us all. But I know how to manage it. But when it spirals and I can see it getting out of control is when I get these irrational, intrusive thoughts that will not go away. And, you know, looking back at 2012, it was the AIB stuff and other stuff. And 2017, I can't even remember, you know, a lot of this stuff is very, but a lot of it is, you know, for me, it's very much, oh, they'd be ashamed of me if they knew this. This friend would be ashamed if they knew I had said this, or my parents wouldn't love me if they really knew this, or work, you know, manager, just your brain going and like literally back 20 or 30 years to try find something, maybe some slight, you know, something you might have said that might have hurt somebody, and just constant, like thousands of times a day, and trigger everything being a fucking trigger for it. And then like having this, I saw there was this kind of routine in my mind where I was worrying about something and imagining then what if I told this person? And so then I would sometimes, you know, call up a friend or my mom or dad or something and say, do you know when I was 15 and said this to you? And they'd be like, no, what? You know, it's just something totally, and I would be in tears apologizing about it. And they'd be like, no, okay. And I'd be like, okay, well, no, it's actually worse. And it was always to like, no, I'm not a good person. And so I'd get this brief relief after like confessing, quote unquote. I should like make it clear. I haven't like murdered anyone or anything. Like there's no underlying thing there. I've really thought about it. Not murder, but I've really thought about the bad things I've done, should I say. And there's nothing there. I don't live that interesting a life, but it became that kind of ritual. And then you'd have a brief moment of relief and then it'd be the next thing. And, oh, this total urge all the time to say something. And, you know, I think a lot of that is tied up in self-worth and everything else. I don't know. I have a therapist. The way it works in America is you have a therapist who you talk to, and then you have a psychiatrist who just gives you drugs I mean, it's different part, but like, you know, kind of psychiatrists, you call them once or twice a month, once every month or two, and they're like, here's your script. But I don't know. I read a book in 22 that obsessive compulsive disorder, which to me was always like, you know, making sure the taps were turned off and checking the door 500 times.
Yeah, all those rituals, yeah.
Yeah, I read this book that I come across somehow because through all my Googling, but it really explained that actually what I was going through was obsessive compulsive disorder, obsessing over these irrational, unimportant thoughts, and then having this compulsion to do something, to act on them. And yeah, I tell you, after I read that book, I went to my psychiatrist, who probably should have picked up on this herself. But I was like, I'm on medicine for depression. I think I need to be on medicine for depression, anxiety, and OCD.
Mm.
And she was kind of like, yeah, that's a good idea. And yeah, that I've been on that 2 years now, and it's really helped. It's really helped. But it's also, I've now finally started to cop on a bit slow, you know, in my 33rd year of life, copping on that actually drinking and exercise and everything else is extremely important. So that's where I'm now. I'm figuring a lot of that out, and I'm much more aware of when I'm about to spiral, and I know that I can try pull back. But yeah, the fear's always there. So that took a bit of a while to figure out too. All of these things sound probably very obvious to most of your listeners. They're like, duh.
What's your relationship like with drinking now?
Better. A lot better, but still, I would say, problematic. You know, this is where Irish people, we just make a joke. You're like, but you know, 8 or 9 pints is great. So I could definitely, there's been points where I've seen where I'm like, oh, I need this drink. I feel like I need this. And I don't like when I feel that. And like some, you know, I'm on the road a lot, so I'm out with different crews and stuff. So there's times where you'll have a few drinks every night, a few nights on the road, because you're working with different teams you don't see all the time. But a lot of it is just that can quickly catch up on you. And then I think like COVID kind of had a thing where a lot of us, I would never have drank alone before, because again, I would have been like, what's the point? Drinking is for the crack with the lads, with everybody, you know. But COVID then, and yeah, I didn't like that for a bit of maybe 21 or 22. There was evenings where I was at home alone and I felt like I needed to have the drink. So yeah, it's one of those things, but I could definitely see if I've drank a few days in a row, or if I've had a big weekend, I can actually feel the irrational thoughts. I can feel the shakiness. And if it's been a very big weekend, I can feel like these thoughts slipping back in. And it's a real fucking wake up call to, because I don't want to go back there. I feel like this is a therapy session. You're good at this.
You do seem to be adopting the same approach that you described that you brought to therapy years ago. You're just like all in. we're going for this.
Yeah. I got very little sleep last night. Plane got in late, so I'm half delirious. So I'm, you know, I'll after I have a proper night's sleep, I'll be like, what did I tell Richie? Jesus Christ. I'm oversharing. But yeah, I mean, you've been through obviously a lot of this.
Mm.
You said when you went to therapy, did you embrace it?
I did, in that I kept showing up and I didn't ever like fail to show for a session. It took me a while to either trust the therapist or trust the process or let myself just go. I don't know what phrase I'm looking for, but I didn't go in on day one and go, right, this is it, I'm ready to talk. I was there, but I was apprehensive, I was cautious, but I also knew I needed it. I think that's how I would have described it back then.
Yeah. And look, I mean, I think it's not as if I went in and was open, but I think also I still took a lot of time. Sometimes it's taken years to really get the, in therapy, get the thing out of my mouth that I'm maybe perhaps was holding back consciously or subconsciously. So it's not, you know, as if I was like, here's all my problems and here's how I know, here's the fundamental reason that I feel this way. So yeah, that takes time. I mean, almost in some ways, and I realize I'm kind of talking about myself here now in terms of this podcast, but like in some ways being is the oversharing, is the act of laying it all out. Is that also a cover for something? You know, is it better to fill the airtime with these things and not, is that trying to drown out something else? And I think I found over the years, you know, a lot of stuff I'm talking about now is stuff that I have learned kind of through years of it, but that I, you know, I would have focused on very small parts of it for a while. Whereas, you know, I by no means have it all figured out now, but there's a lot of things that I'm probably saying to you today, which first 3-4 years of therapy and everything else would not have dawned on me.
Mm. I still go every week as well, and unfortunately I'm still uncovering shit.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
Or understanding the shit a bit more or differently.
How long have you had your therapist?
Oh, years and years and years. And I find I go because a lot of the work I do can be quite stressful, and we've you know, we've a little baby, and I just know the importance of me kind of minding myself in it all. And often I'd go with nothing particular to talk about, and sometimes I go with my head in my hand going, I'm doing too much. I need some kind of guidance or help. But it's not something I'm allowing myself step away from for the moment. I think I would, I just feel at the moment it's something that I want to stay doing.
Yeah. And yeah, I find I go through that too. I mean, I'm not the best practitioner of what I preach at the moment. I probably see my therapist once or twice a month. Depends on work and travel and everything else. But then, of course, if I'm going through something, I'll want to see her twice a week. But yeah, a lot of it is, you know, it's like anything else. A lot of it is actually just in the days where you go, like, there's so many, when I'm feeling good, I'm like, why the fuck am I wasting 45 minutes going doing this? I have nothing to say to her today. And I also don't want to talk about this because, you know, it might upset me and I'm in grand form. But it is kind of those days that they're more definitely the building blocks of, you know, preventing an absolute spiral. So, but it can be hard to keep yourself motivated from it. And sometimes it's okay, I find, to, you know, take a step back for a few weeks and then come back to it. I'm also, you know, I think that's the shocking thing, is that I'm very aware that having a therapist is a very privileged place to be in, right? And that's like, you know, I've friends and at home still and elsewhere that, and I think I went through it a bit in when I was first signing up to therapists in the north and at home in Kerry, like, you know, the ones that are provided by free healthcare or whatever, like they ask you these questions before you get the therapist, like, oh, have you thought of killing yourself? Or have you, these, and you basically have to say that you're on the verge of throwing yourself off a bridge before they actually move you up the line. And that's those questions, that process is very upsetting. I would tell anyone now to tell them, no matter how bad you think you are, tell them you're worse so you can start seeing someone. Thing is that when I first started trying to get to see a therapist, I frankly, I don't want to say suicidal because that's very tough, but like there was certainly, you know, definitely places where you're like, I can't keep doing this. But then if you have never had interaction with, you know, psychotherapy, etc., you're asked immediately, have you had this feeling, that feeling? Have you had suicidal ideation? Even if you're in that place, you don't want to admit to yourself. Like, the last thing I wanted to admit to myself was I was maybe as bad as I was. So I think that's kind of a scary thing when it comes to, you know, just getting access to a doctor in the first place.
Mm. I want to talk about your job. Your role takes you to loads of interesting places. Trump rallies, or you attend QAnon gatherings, and you meet with a lot of people who are fully on board with conspiracy theories and have a lot of beliefs that often people would look in from the outside and describe as irrational, and people often can be quite dismissive and mocking of those people. You don't have that approach. You see, when I watch you speak to them, you kind of adopt a kind of a warm, curious, empathic, sometimes a bit of a jokey kind of persona.
Yeah, I tried to. Look, I mean, if our conversation over the past hour or so shows anything, I think we're all capable of believing crazy things. You know, I kind of say, I don't think you have to be crazy to believe crazy stuff. In my case, it's inward. It's believing extremely irrational things about myself that drives myself mad. Everything else in life, you know, life goes on and you have to do your job and everything else. And anybody else looking at you might not know that you're actually tearing yourself apart about how shit you think you are. So I see, like, a lot of the people I speak to are normal people. They're very productive members of society. They have families, they have jobs, they have businesses. But you ask them about this one thing, it can be the election, it can be QAnon, it can be Trump, it could be something else. And you just see that switch go off in their head. And it kind of reminds me of like when I'm going through something bad, and, you know, like when I talk about that, I had a very bad year, 2022 or whatever, like there was good moments, you know, like I was going out for dinner, I was doing my job, but they were kind of punctuated by this fear. And there's moments that I, you know, I could be going through a thing and I might forget about it for a few minutes. I might forget about whatever my irrational, intrusive thought is of the day, and I'm happy. And then something reminds me. It can be a trigger, it can be a million different things. And then I, you know, I get pulled back in. And I can kind of see that happening with a lot of the people I speak to, is that, like, this is their trigger. And, you know, I think for people who just have kind of seen some of the stuff I do fleetingly, a lot of people say, how'd you talk to those crazy people? And, oh, you're just making a fool of them or whatever. That's really not what I try to do. I think, especially this year, and even why I'm out in Nevada at the moment, is I really am trying to get a lot deeper into why people engage with these irrational thoughts and beliefs. And, you know, I really do want to do a lot more on the mental health role of this, because it's huge. I think just as I might project my insecurities and anxieties onto myself and form these irrational thoughts about myself, I think a lot of people here who are disillusioned or disaffected, their lives aren't going well, they feel like politicians have failed them down. I mean, frankly, a lot of people's lives in this country are totally shit. To have that outlet, to be able to blame something else, there's a comfort in that. And yeah, I've spent a lot of time with groups that are kind of cults and people QAnon and everything else. But I will say, like, you know, a lot of these people who are in these QAnon affiliated groups or whatever, they really get a lot of meaning out of it. They get a sense of community. There's this book that came out in the late 90s or about 2000 called Bowling Alone in the US. And it was a very kind of academic-y book, but basically what it looked at is how in the second half of the 20th century, community clubs in America, people were hanging out less. And the reason it was called Bowling Alone was because these Harvard professors actually looked at the decline of bowling clubs in the US as a way to try and figure out how little time, you know, how less and less time we were spending with each other because, you know, of television and everything else and just busier lifestyles. And now, of course, like, you know, 24 years on, I think I saw a new polling out recently here in the US that people are obviously we're spending more time alone than ever. And I think that is having a profound effect. I mean, stating the obvious, but obviously profound effects. But I think it's having, I think so much of what we are seeing when it comes to this conspiracy theory stuff around election and everything else, it's like most of us get a lot of our perception of the world is through what we're seeing on our in our phone or on our computer, right?
Hmm.
And that's why I think, you know, a lot of the work we do in talking about what information and misinformation people see is why I'm so fascinated by it. And you obviously saw an explosion of this during 2020 too with the COVID lockdown, right? We all were, and also a time of uncertainty, you're looking for answers. Just like how some of the people I might meet whose life isn't going well might want to say, well, it, you know what, it's a Democratic pedophile QAnon cabal that is doing this to me, that's holding me back. Having that sense of that there's a reason for it, that there's a reason my life is shit, that a reason are things the way it is a lot, you know, it's scary, but there's a kind of comfort there because at least there's a reason for it. And I think that's what a lot of people cling on to. And I think kind of similarly, when we talk about anxiety or depression within ourselves, you have these feelings, right? You have feelings of sadness, or you have the sweats or your heart palpitations, and your mind is trying to give meaning to that and it can't process it. And so therefore you end up with these very irrational beliefs. And it takes a lot to unpack that. And I think, you know, for me, what kind of, like, I'll be the first to say that, you know, a lot of the people I meet, they're great fun. And they say, some of the stuff they say is crazy. And I tell them that. And, you know, we have a bit of a laugh. And they'll say, well, you're CNN, fake news. Of course, you're going to tell me this is false. It's a conspiracy theory. But I see, like, a lot of people, what I find almost more interesting is when I do a lot of these interviews, it's the reaction of other people. Because, again, I meet, you know, most of these people I meet, they're not stupid. They've, again, everything else in their life is going great. Or, you know, they're very productive members of society, as I would say. But they have these certain beliefs. And I'll see, like, on Twitter or on whatever, a lot of people will say, especially people who are on the Democratic side, will say, oh, these people are so dumb, or stupid, or lost cause, et cetera, et cetera. And a few months ago, I did an interview with this woman who was at the Capitol on January 6th. She's in her 40s. She's got a lot of kids. She's like seven or eight grandkids or something. But I interviewed her on the weekend before she was going into prison for 5 years. She's in prison right now. She was broke windows in the Capitol and stuff that day. She's totally, totally buying in and still stands by the election was stolen and all the Trump lies that brought her there. But we did a story and, you know, people can watch it. It's on YouTube. Her name is Rachel Powell. You'll see. And I talked to her and we show what she's done. We showed the video over and over again of her attacking the Capitol. We show, you know, what she's been charged of. But I spoke to her like she was a human being, which she is. And we pointed out in the story that she has a lot of kids and a lot of young kids, and she's leaving them behind. And the story I was obviously telling was like, this is a tragedy no matter what way you look at it. This woman has been misled in this way, or has wanted to buy into this stuff for whatever reason. And this is the story. But because we gave her that airtime, because we told that story, which in my mind is showing the true effects of this sort of stuff, so many people on like the left, as you call it here, Democrats, are saying, why are you showing this woman any sympathy? Why does she deserve to have her story told? And the thing that's most stood out to me is, why are you humanizing this woman? Because she's human. And I think that's, you know, we are so quick. And I cover misinformation extremist groups, and 95% of my reporting is on the right and on the Trump, because that's just where it is most pronounced at the moment. And that is what is the kind of threat to the democracy as such. But we're very, I think everybody's very quick to say, Trumpers crazy. They are the cause of all the division in the country. But if the other side aren't willing to see these people as humans, then we're screwed. And, you know, a lot of people who, I mean, for the mental health and sake of most people who are listening, I'm sure they're not into the world of conspiracy theories as much as I am. But, you know, there's this big thing of calling people pedophiles, right? You know, Joe Biden's a pedophile. Whoever you don't like is a pedophile. And that seems just bizarre and out there in terms of like, why is that what people go to? But it actually goes back centuries to anti-Semitism, or just goes back centuries generally, very much cast in anti-Semitic in the Middle Ages and still now. But if you call somebody a pedophile, you know, the most abhorrent thing you can do to a human, basically, in terms of the act of pedophilia, if you can make somebody believe that someone's a pedophile, you're basically, you've dehumanized that person, because you'll say, well, do you know what? That person deserves whatever they get. And so that dehumanization is happening on the right, and Democrats talk about how it's dangerous. But the same thing is happening on the left in that degree too.
Yeah, just the language is different. So back to you, just to finish. It's an election year. I assume there's an intensity to the world of American politics, and you're bang in the middle of it. Do you have to be extra vigilant in any way to mind yourself through it, or do external events like that, are they incidental? Do you just have to mind yourself now at this stage, no matter what's going on in the world?
Yeah, it's just, I mean, I'm definitely, first time in my life, I've tried to get a bit of an exercise regime in and all the kind of boring stuff, but I really can see, you know, whereas before I just wouldn't have thought of any of that. Now I can really see, you know, it's not just the pills that are going to keep me okay. So there's a bit of that. I've got to get home to Ireland a bit over the summer. So that'll help. That's a good anchor for everything. In more ways than one.
Listen, I want to thank you so much for joining us on the podcast and for being so open and insightful and interesting. Congrats on everything you've achieved in your career, and really, really wish you well in managing yourself and with everything you have going on. Thanks a million, Donny.
Really appreciate it. And I mean, I feel, you know, if you were in New York, you'd be charging me $400 for this therapy session now. So I feel like I just got it for free. So thanks very much, Richie.
God, he's a likable fella, isn't he? Like, he really is. And he did, like he said there, he just launched himself. He threw himself fully into that chat from the start. What a guest. I loved him.
Yeah, he's a great, great guy. And he was great when I was talking to him beforehand as well. Mm. And as I said at the top of the show, like, what I was really interested in was like how he is now 3 years on from first speaking about experiencing anxiety and depression. And what really struck me was how things have continued to evolve for him, both in terms of diagnosis and how he looks after himself. Like, it's not as simple as, oh, this is why I've been feeling like this, this is my diagnosis, and this is what I need to do, then just, you know, copy and paste for the rest of your life. It's very much a continuous thing.
Yeah, if only things were that simple, eh? Just copy and paste for eternity. Right, on to next week, where we are going to be joined by another really exciting guest, this time from London. So until then, another massive thanks to Donny for speaking to us today. Thank you, Killian.
Thanks, Richie.
And thanks, everyone, for listening. Episode is a Second Captain's production and is part of the Acast Creator Network.
Whose phone is that? That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
The Second Captain's.
Second Captain, First Captain, whatever.